Hello and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is director Gordon Douglas. Born in 1907, Douglas started out as a child actor while also working behind the scenes at MGM and Hal Roach Studios. In 1934, he began assistant directing, graduating to full director in 1936 of the Little Rascals shorts, one of which, Board of Education, won an Oscar for Best Live Action Short Film. He continued directing the R-Gang comedies for a few more years, graduating to full-length features with 1939's Zenobia, starring Oliver Hardy but not Stan Laurel. He would direct both Laurel and Hardy in the next year's Saps at Sea. Douglas would go on to direct films for the next 37 years across multiple studios and genres. He would helm comedies, musicals, biopics, westerns, horror, sci-fi, war films, even one installment of RKO's Dick Tracy franchise, Dick Tracy vs. Cue Ball. His career got a boost by working with the legendary James Cagney in 1950's Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye, and then Gregory Peck in 1951's Only the Valiant. He made a lasting contribution to the 50s sci-fi by directing the 1954 classic Them, following that up with the musical Young at Heart starring Doris Day and Frank Sinatra, his first of five films with old blue eyes. In the 1960s alone, he directed features starring Bob Hope, Elvis Presley, and Jerry Lewis. He was behind the camera for both of Sinatra's Tony Rome films and directed sequels to three different franchises: 1967's In Like Flint with James Coburn, 1970's They Called Me Mr. Tibbs with Sidney Poitier, and 1973's Slaughter's Big Ripoff starring Jim Brown. After a few years off, he returned to feature films one last time for the 1977 spectacular Viva Knievel. Joining me to discuss Viva Knievel and the career of Gordon Douglas is the co-host of the TV Movie Rewind podcast, Matt Sirois. Hi, Matt.
Hello. Very happy to be here.
Thank you so much. And thank you for doing this specific episode, Matt. I mean, you and I have recorded together before, and I always enjoy talking to you. But for anyone not super familiar with the show, the way I do it is I let the guest decide what subject they want to cover. And that, you know, sort of forces me to maybe check out films I wouldn't normally watch. And I learn a lot because I read books or whatever. But this film, Viva Knievel, is one of my all-time favorite terrible movies. I've known about it for decades, and I never knew anyone else who appreciated it. And then one day, I just said, you know what, the hell with it. Let's try and, you know, like retrofit an episode, because I learned that Viva Knievel was Gordon Douglas's last film. And I thought, well, this is just too good to pass up for Fade Out. So I mentioned it on Fade Out's Twitter feed, and Matt was very generous to jump in and agreed to do the show with me and review the career of Gordon Douglas. So, Matt, I really owe you one.
Well, I was excited. I saw Viva Knievel, and I was like, I didn't know anybody else but me talked about this movie. Or, you know, I actually own it on DVD. It's one of the oldest films in my collection. I grew up an Evel Knievel fan, and when I found out he did a movie, I'm like, well, I got to see that someday. And happened upon it. I believe it was in a Best Buy in 2005. It was on the DVD rack, and I'm like, yep, this is coming home with me.
There is so much to say about this movie, but first, before we get to the fun of Viva Knievel, we do need to talk about Gordon Douglas, because again, that's really the subject of the episode, is Gordon Douglas's career. I mentioned that he was born in 1907. He passed away on September 29th, 1993. So if you were listening to this episode the day it drops, that is 30 years ago exactly that when he passed away. And again, I thought that was just too much. It was fate. It was fate that we talk about this. And, you know, other episodes of Fade Out, we've been fortunate that most of the time, a lot of the final films we discuss are pretty good, or at the very least, you know, not bad. And it's a way to discuss the whole career. And even if the last one isn't their best work, that's fine. But when someone's last film is abjectly terrible, you know, I never want to seem like we're making fun of this person, because look, I've never made a movie. I will never make a movie. Making even the most barely competent film is a Herculean task, and it deserves to be celebrated in any respect, because it still takes a lot of work to make, like I said, even, you know, the worst movie out there. So we're never making fun of the career, ever. And as we're going to go through, we'll see there's a lot of great movies in Gordon Douglas's career. I mean, the man directed 98 features, which says something about the time he grew up in, because nowadays movie directors, nobody gets to do 98 movies. No director, you know, directing in the 21st century who started their career in the 21st century is ever going to direct 98 films. They're just never going to get a chance to hone their craft like that. And so there's a lot of good stuff in Gordon Douglas's filmography. So the fact that he ended his career on something so profoundly head-shakingly awful is, you know, just one of the vagaries of having a Hollywood career, I guess. So again, we'll get to Viva Knievel shortly. But so, Matt, when I pitched this to you and we talked about Gordon Douglas and you went back and started seeing some of his films, which ones, you know, I'm guessing like me, you found that you had already seen a bunch of them because the guy directed so many different kinds of movies.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I was surprised, you know, because at first the name wasn't really familiar. And then, like I said, I just looked up his filmography and I'm like, wow, I own a good portion of the movies that he's directed. And he's actually directed two of my favorite Westerns, Rio Conchos and Vaquero, as well as, you know, Them, which is, you know, one of the most popular giant bug atomic movies from that time period. It's almost fitting that he would be this month's subject, whereas last month you talked about Sylvia Sidney, who was very, very particular about the project she took. And clearly, Gordon Douglas was not particular at all.
Yeah, I could not find a single interview with Mr. Douglas. Apparently, there was in 1988, the LA Times did some sort of career retrospective with him. I think probably they were celebrating Them, because, you know, we'll go through some of his movies. Them is certainly his most famous title. But I couldn't find that article. It's not online. And so which is unfortunate, because I love reading books about the subject and I like hearing, you know, hearing their own words about what they feel about their career. We don't have that in this instance. Maybe it's because Gordon Douglas was such a journeyman that, you know, he probably was somebody who didn't think who would want to interview me. He's, you know, he's not an auteur, that kind of thing. And of course, you know, his career ended in the 70s, which was sort of the height of the auteur theory, you know, that the director is the sole author of the film. The single quote from Gordon Douglas that I could find was apparently something he gave to a fellow director, where he said, "I have a large family to feed, and it's only occasionally that I find a story that interests me." So that tells you right there, he regarded film directing as a job. It was a job like anything else. Yes, he's bringing creativity to it, like you have to. Again, even to be the worst director, you're bringing some level of creativity to what you're doing. But he really seemed like he just took whatever job was offered him. And sometimes he scored well. Again, we'll talk about some of his better ones. Sometimes not so much. We'll talk about some of those as well. You know, I mean, at the same time, this is a guy who worked with, I mentioned some of the names in the intro. This is a guy whose career encompassed working with Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Jimmy Cagney, Laurel and Hardy, Bela Lugosi, Sidney Poitier, Gregory Peck, Doris Day, Liberace, Bob Hope, Roger Moore, The Little Rascals, Jim Brown, Jerry Lewis, and of course, Evel Knievel. I mean, that is a hell of a career, just to be able to say you've interacted with that wide a swath of Hollywood. That's worth celebrating all by itself.
You know, he obviously took the job very seriously, regardless of what the film or the material was, and worked to the best of his ability, which is obviously also why studios went to him to say, "We want you to direct this."
He could get it done. I mean, this was an era when Hollywood was cranking out hundreds of films a year, A pictures, B pictures, you know, stuff for all sorts of, you know, drive-ins and big A ticket sort of road shows and stuff like that. And you needed lots of product. I mean, these were movies that once, of course, you know, back in the day, once they disappeared forever. One, they might show up on television, but there was no home video market. And so you needed constant product, and you need a guy like a Gordon Douglas. You need somebody who can go in, get it done presumably on budget, and get it finished. And like one of the movies that I saw in researching for this episode is called Skin Game, which was a forgive the term, like a slave comedy starring James Gardner, I love James Gardner, and Louis Gossett Jr. And that was originally directed by Paul Bogart. And apparently Bogart got sick so much that he had to stop filming. And they brought in Gordon Douglas. And Gordon Douglas directed it for like a couple of weeks. Back then, movies were like done in a month, so he probably shot half of it. And then maintained the film long enough for Bogart to get better, handed it back to him, and bang, the movie's done. You know, I mean, that's your guy. He's like a utility infielder or something. I don't know sports, but I hope I used the metaphor correctly. So now you mentioned that he directed some of your favorite Westerns. Is Westerns a genre that you like particularly really enjoy?
Oh, yes. It actually makes up probably the greatest portion of my DVD and Blu-ray collection. Grew up loving Westerns with, you know, my dad, my uncles, and my paternal grandfather. We're always, you know, we would sometimes go over to visit on the weekends, and usually my grandfather and a couple of my uncles, my dad's second oldest of a large family, so he had brothers. I had uncles that were still kind of teenagers and living at home, and we'd go over, and they'd usually be surrounded the TV watching Westerns, and I grew up with a deep appreciation for them.
I think that's something that modern audiences just cannot appreciate, that for the 40s through maybe the, well, probably even earlier than that, 30s through the very late 60s, Westerns, I think it's fair to say, were still the predominant genre that Hollywood was making. They could be made relatively cheaply, and you could get, you know, you could have Westerns that are, you know, Z grade level kind of stuff, you know, Last of the Wild Horses by like Lippert or something. And then you go to on the other end of the spectrum, you got High Noon, you know, starring like the top tier level talent. So you mentioned one of Gordon Douglas's Westerns, Barquero, which I had not seen until I was researching this episode, and stars the great Warren Oates, right? So right there, you're like, oh, I'm halfway there. It's got Warren Oates. That's going to be fun to watch. And Lee Van Cleef, which, you know, again, like, you know, that's something else I think about Gordon Douglas, for a guy who seemingly, again, we're only going by that one quote, but seemingly kind of wasn't super dedicated to his craft as being like an auteur. Again, not dedicated in a bad way, but just not thinking of himself as this great auteur. He was clearly no pushover, because look at the people he's working with. You know, Sinatra. He did five movies with Sinatra. Nobody does five movies with Frank Sinatra unless he can find a way to get done what he needs to get done. But could you imagine coming on set with Lee Van Cleef and Warren Oates? Like, how intimidating would that be?
I mean, you know, the testosterone must have been through the roof on that set.
Oh, my God. So, now, what were the other ones you mentioned? What was it? Rio Concho? Was that one of the other ones?
Rio Conchos, which was Jim Brown's first film.
Another tough guy.
Yep. One of the greatest athletes of all time. And that one stars Richard Boone. And there's a lot of, there's certain plot similarities to, and I seem to be the only one who seems to think this, so maybe I'm wrong, but you watch the movie and there are certain plot points that make me think of Bridge Over the River Kwai, because Richard Boone is kind of shanghaied into a military mission that he doesn't really want to be involved in. He's looking for revenge against the tribe of natives that killed his family, and the tribe of natives that killed his family were using stolen military guns. So the military is looking for those guns as well. So they shanghai him along with for the ride. And the movie ends with a large explosion. Most of the cast is killed. And of the heroes, only the commander of the mission, who was wounded in the leg, makes it away with some native women as, you know, everything falls apart.
It does sound like River Kwai, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that was intentional or just how it worked out.
Hmm. So, I mean, I mentioned in the intro, you know, that Douglas seemed to hop from genre to genre to genre. I mean, he did at least like one of everything. I would argue that the most genre films that he has on his filmography are Westerns, because like we were saying, that was back when Westerns were really the coin of the realm for almost every Hollywood studio. And so if you're going to direct 98 movies over the course of almost 40 years, you're going to end up directing a lot of Westerns. That's just it's just the way the wheel is going to spin around on you. So Westerns is a genre that I enjoy as much as any others, but I it's certainly not, I don't have as many under my belt as, say, horror or sci-fi. You said you really enjoy Westerns. Now, one of the things I was wondering if it's even possible to pin down with Gordon Douglas, and maybe you can speak to this just within the realm of Westerns. Does he have any sort of identifiable style, evil, either visually or thematically or tonally? I wasn't getting anything. He really did seem like a guy that could do anything because he wasn't necessarily bringing a whole ton of his personal, you know, sort of neuroses or biases or whatever word you want to use behind it.
No, in fact, it really seems like he would maybe judge the tone of the Western he was making and try to match the tone that, you know, try to bring that tone to life and leave any type of his own personal views away from it, because he made at least two Westerns with Randolph Scott, who is my favorite Western actor. Mm-hmm. And Randolph Scott Westerns tend to be the very traditional Hollywood Western with the hero riding tall in the saddle. You know, he's a very clean cut. He's very, very white hat. It is all definite black and white, good versus evil, very little ambiguity. Mm-hmm. And in particular with the Nevadan, which is a really fun Western starring Randolph Scott. And then from there, he went on to, well, at least for the ones I've seen, he went on to Rio Conchos, which is a much angrier, edgier Western, as Westerns were becoming at that time. And then Vaquero has full on that European Western influence that Sergio Leone and all the Italian and European filmmakers were bringing to Westerns that were more popular. And it is a, you know, you've seen Vaquero yourself. It is very dark edge. I mean, mm-hmm. the movie opens with Warren Oates and his gang massacring a town of men, women, and children in order to steal a gun. And they're very distinctly, they're three distinctly different Westerns I would not have imagined were directed by the same person.
That's cool.
In fact,
cool,
another, another interesting Western he directed was a 3D Western, Charge at Feather River, which is where it wasn't the first use of the Wilhelm scream, but it's where the Wilhelm scream gets its name from.
Is the character Wilhelm?
It's the character of Wilhelm getting shot in an with an arrow and the scream coming out.
That's fantastic. That's another great contribution to cinematic history, courtesy of Gordon Douglas and his sound department. That's that's fantastic. Yeah, I enjoyed Barcaro quite a bit. Forrest Tucker is in the movie as a cheerfully cruel mountain man, which I found to be, you know, fun to watch because it's really creepy. Like, he has this whole bit where he like pours fire ants on somebody, and it's like, oh God, this is, you know, and it's, you mentioned,
and he's
like
one of the good guys,
and he's one of the good guys, right? Yeah. He's kind of working. He's helping Lee Van Cleef. But that's interesting. You mentioned that you could feel like there's some influence from the Italian Westerns on American films. Cause I mean, that happens a lot. We heard about that, like, you know, Hitchcock saw Diabolique and was like, oh man, I got to up my game here. And the result is Psycho. You know, I mean, he's a guy who's like, and, you know, Clouseau is inspired by Hitchcock, and then he in turn then inspires Hitchcock himself, you know? So that's really interesting. Again, Barcaro, I think, was the only one of his Westerns that I saw. I think, again, my own biases were like, I leaned towards some other stuff. I mentioned Dick Tracy versus Cueball, which was one of those RKO programmers that they made back then. The film is like 51 minutes long. It's meant to run as a, you know, the support slot. And I love the Warren Beatty movie, the Warren Beatty Dick Tracy. Not as much as Warren Beatty loves it, but I love it. And as much as that film is the filmic version of the Color Sundays of Dick Tracy, the black and white grimy little Dick Tracy versus Cueball to me is an adaptation of the black and white dailies, because it's a grimy, maybe the print that I saw was pretty bad. I'm sure it's not been restored or anything, but it's a gritty, dark little movie. And it even opens with the credits of the characters as drawn by Chester Gould. And then they morph into the actor playing the role. And there is some really moody shots to it. I mean, again, I'm not going to say it's film noir. That's going too far. But it's got a lot more mood and style to it than I would have imagined. And I went into it thinking, oh, this is going to be boring as hell because it's, you know, Dick Tracy versus Cue Ball. And about halfway through, I'm going, this isn't that, this is pretty good. Like, I really kind of liked it. And then it made me sorry that Gordon Douglas, maybe in his desire to never be pigeonholed, didn't do more of them. Because, like, he showed real facility at this. So this is really pretty good. But again, maybe he was determined to just, I'm just going to do the next different thing as possible because that's how I'm going to stay employed.
Or the next job that came along just happened to be different and it led to another job and he never got back to it.
Maybe so. I mean, another one of the greatest examples of that, of course, is Them, which is showing on TCM this month in September because they're doing like their big bug stuff. And apparently Steven Spielberg has done one of the intros and he mentions Them as one of his favorite films. And I hadn't seen Them in probably 25 years. And then I watched it again for this episode and I was really, I won't say shocked, but pleasantly surprised how good it is. It's not just the premise is what's memorable or the visuals. It's a really well done movie. It is executed well. It's got a lot of tension. It's really eerie. I looked it up and saw that there were only three ant puppets that they had to work with through the whole film. So Douglas had to be very, very smart in deploying them because, you know, I mean, not that three giant ants wouldn't be scary, but he had to kind of get the maximum terror out of them. And I could see that if that film had been directed by somebody less skillful, it might still be memorable because it's giant ants and that was something that they really hadn't seen before. But I'm like, no, this is genuinely a really good movie. And once again, I'm kind of sorry that he didn't work more in sci-fi horror because I think he clearly had some facility for it.
There is a sequence in Them that terrified me as a kid. And it's been burned into my memory. I've seen the movie numerous times over the years, but this particular sequence, even when I was a kid, scarred me. And there's no special effects at all. It is because it's just done so brilliantly. It's at the beginning of the film, James Whitmore and his partner, they're playing police officers who have been called to a crime scene, and it's a general store. And they arrive there and they find the destruction. And Whitmore says to his partner, go around back and see if you can find anything. And the camera follows, the camera remains inside the shop and it follows, you know, the movement of the officer you can't see until he walks by a window and you see his silhouette against the window as he moves outside. And then you hear a creepy noise and then you hear the officer scream and it's all done off camera. But that just terrified me because it's all in your imagination what just happened. Because we don't know it's giant ants yet. We don't know anything yet. All we know is that an officer has just met a grisly death.
Yeah, it's really effective.
And I would even say some of the ending, like the final battle, might have inspired Aliens a little bit. Because you've got these soldiers moving through these tunnels in a hive, fighting giant bugs with flamethrowers.
All they need is that little tracer thing that tells them how close the ants are. You know, well, 8 meters, that's in the room.
They're even looking for two little lost boys that are in there, you know?
Yeah, it's a really terrific movie.
A surprising climax.
What do you mean by surprise? I mean, I kind of know what you mean, but what do you mean, surprising climax?
I know when I probably rewatched it as I was a little older, I was surprised that the hero that you have followed from the beginning of the movie is killed. And basically, you know, the secondary hero, it takes over from there. You know, I did not expect that.
Yeah. It's a really, really good movie. I've seen a lot of sci-fi. I've seen a lot of giant bugs, you know, to quote Bela Lugosi from Ed Wood, giant bugs, giant spiders, you know, but a lot of them are not very good. You know, a couple of years ago, I went and saw The Blob on the big screen and I was like, this movie's not that great. The Blob is memorable as a creature, but the movie around it is not that great. But Them is genuinely good. And as much as I've enjoyed some of other Gordon Douglas's movies, it's like, man, it would have been interesting if he had gotten other assignments like this and he could have brought what he brought to Them for these other features. But, you know, at least we have the one, because again, that is, it is terrific. So, what other films of his did you watch before we get to Viva Knievel? Cause God, I can't wait to talk about that movie, but what other ones of his did you see in preparation for this that you hadn't seen before?
Well, I watched a bunch of his Our Gang, shorts, and I actually watched them interspersed with, you know, other directors just to see again if I could tell a difference, and I could not. But you know, I grew up watching The Little Rascals. They used to be on, you know, early Sunday mornings along with The Three Stooges. And, you know, it's a little cringy, some of the antics now, but it's still, I found them very charming. And at the end of the day, you get these shorts of an ethnically diverse group of kids who are hanging out together and playing like it's no big deal, which is really amazing when you consider this is from like the 30s.
I imagine directing a bunch of kids is probably just as difficult as, say, directing Frank Sinatra in terms of unruliness.
Yeah, but you know what? I wouldn't be surprised if he was able to, like, pick up, because some of these kids were very little. You pick them up and you shake them and you say, stop it.
That you could not do with Frank Sinatra.
Now I know why I'm named Spanky.
Yeah, I mean... as I mentioned in the intro, one of his Little Rascal shorts won an Oscar.
Yeah.
It wasn't best directing. He didn't personally get the Oscar, but isn't that amazing to think that a Little Rascal short won an Oscar for best live action short film? I'm sure that they weren't thinking that when they were cranking those movies out, probably, you know, two a week.
And I'll tell you, I had a fun time watching them again. You know, you'd cringe every now and then from a certain thing, but you know, for the most part, they were pretty charming and harmless. Some of the titles that he has directed, I mean, you got to believe that Gordon Douglas was alive and well in the Simpsons universe, and he directed every movie that Troy McClure ever did. You know, you got movies like The Fiend That Walked the West. I Was a Communist for the FBI. Sins of Rachel Cade, The Devil with Hitler. And then, of course, the Bela Lugosi Zombies on Broadway. Those sound like Troy McClure starred in each one of them.
I have never seen Zombies on Broadway. Is that any good? I've heard of it. I've read about it, but I've never actually seen it.
Is it good? Not really. It's nice to, like, because Lugosi did... Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla.
That with, I have seen.
Mitchell and Petrillo, who were obviously just ripping off Martin and Lewis. And while the two guys in Kearney and Brown are kind of Abbott and Costello-ish, they at least weren't trying to be Abbott and Costello clone. You know, the guy who is the Costello guy is never like going, oh, Abbott, help me. You know, they at least kind of had their own personalities while they were doing an Abbott and Costello type of script.
Okay.
But I'm not sure I'm a huge Bela Lugosi fan, so that's why, you know, I gave it a watch. I'm not entirely sure it's worth, you know, if you want to watch a Bela Lugosi movie, my recommendation will always be The Return of the Vampire.
I like that one. They just ran that on Svengoolie, I think, just last week. That's a really fun one.
Yeah. That's my favorite.
I know you watch this. I'm going to pretend like I don't know you watch it because I'm bringing it up. 1970s Skullduggery.
Skullduggery may be the most definitive Gordon Douglas movie in that, like Gordon Douglas's career, Skullduggery is not easily defined.
Nope.
It is a little bit of everything, and it is all over the place, and sometimes you're not even sure it's an actual happening thing.
Burt Reynolds and Roger C. Carmel, Susan Clark, go into the jungle and find a missing race of missing link ape creatures that live in the jungle, and then get involved in bringing them back into civilization, which leads to a court trial featuring Blackula himself, William Marshall.
One character gets way too involved with one of the female missing links. And there's also a scene in that movie that is the most mundane reaction to a person's horrible death that you will probably ever see on screen. They're marching through the jungle with their guide, and their guide says, oh, we can't go this way. You see this marker? That means there's this, you know, very hostile native tribe here. We can go no further. And Burt Reynolds doesn't want to go around, so he picks up the totem and throws it over the cliff there nearby and says, we're going. And the guide gets intimidated and says, all right, I guess we're going. And the guy turns around, takes an arrow, and falls off the cliff screaming to his death. And everybody's reaction is basically, well, I guess we do have to go around.
People were tougher back then, Matt. he just dealt with adversity a lot more different. That movie, I watch it on YouTube. It is gobsmacking of just that is tonally. It is all over the place. It's not a great movie, but it is fun to watch.
It was a movie I decided I had to own, and I have bought the Blu-ray.
It's on Blu-ray?
It's on Blu-ray. It's even got, you know, commentary on it by some film historians.
Oh, my God. Does it really? Oh, my God. Wow.
I haven't listened to that yet, but I watched a good portion of it on YouTube. And then I'm like, no, I'm owning this, and I'm watching it as high def as I can possibly get it. And I loved every second of it.
Take in the sumptuous visuals.
That jungle filming is really nice. It does look really
nice. Oh, it looks good. No, I'm sorry. I don't mean to mock it. I'm just, it's like, it looks good. It does, it's, you know, it had a budget, clearly. It's Burt Reynolds before he became Burt Reynolds. They're kind of catching him as before Deliverance and things like that. But it is a gonzo movie. And then the end scene in the court, it is just like, wow. What audience were they thinking was out weird there for this movie?
I imagine it had to have been inspired. They were inspired to make it by the success of the Planet of the Apes movies, because that's the only thing. I think it came out 2 years after the original Planet of the Apes. And that's how, because you like the Planet of the Apes, you got these bizarre, you know, human ape-like man ape things, and you have a big courtroom trial that's kind of the centerpiece. But it is, I mean, how many movies can you think of start out as a jungle adventure where two treasure hunters are just joining, you know, an expedition to hunt for, you know, basically treasure? They come across a missing link, and then it ends up with a courtroom murder case about what it means to be human and what is a human being really.
It's like Planet of the Apes with like Inherit the Wind thrown in.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
It's a movie that doesn't realize how insane it is, which is what makes it so awesome.
Well, there's another film on his filmography we could say that about. We'll get to that very shortly. So there's a couple things I wanted to mention that I watched. I saw both the Tony Rome films, Tony Rome, and then the sequel Lady in Cement. Those films, you know, movies deserve to be judged in the era that they were made. You know, you can't go by, you can't attach a modern lens really onto, you know, on older films and judge it. Oh, it's not very, you know, it's not very enlightened. Well, they made it in 1967. That said, the Tony Rome films are a rough watch. They are, I mean, the whole universe of those movies, it's the world is run by doughy white guys who just smoke and stand around and talk. And every other kind of person, an African-American or Hispanic or women or gay guys, they are all just, you know, tools for the white men's use, and they are rough going. They are really, really rough going. Now, I know he did The Detective, which confusingly is not a Tony Rome film, even though it was made in between those two Tony Rome films that I mentioned, and was directed by Gordon Douglas, and it was sold as a DVD box set of all three films, but it is not a Tony Rome film, right? You've seen that one.
I saw it once many years ago, based on the fact that I found out that it's kind of technically the prequel to Die Hard.
Right.
And, you know, I watched it on that. And, you know, I honestly didn't really care for it all that much. It's a decent detective story. And they tried to be a bit more positive on the gay community that is a big part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But they still end up failing miserably because, right. You know, just it's at a time where they didn't just quite get it. They tried. Their intentions were there. But it still comes off as, you know, very unfortunately stereotypical and backwards.
Yeah, the first Tony Rome film has multiple shots of women in bikinis bending over, and then the camera zooms in on their rears like it's laughing, and you're just like, what, you know, what is this? This was a movie made by like guys in their 50s. And it's got the maturity of like an 11-year-old. You know, it really is kind of cringeworthy in a lot of ways. Now, for anyone just to explain, the thing with Die Hard is, as far as I understand it, Die Hard is based on a book, which is a sequel to the book that they made The Detective out of.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. So Roderick Thorpe wrote The Detective, and then he wrote Nothing Lasts Forever, which is the sequel to The Detective, featuring the same character that Sinatra plays. That book was made eventually into Die Hard.
Right. And supposedly when they were trying to develop the second book into a movie, Sinatra had the rights to it. He had first dibs on it. And this was in an era where he was still around. And he apparently had expressed some modicum of interest in doing it, and the producers were like, oh god, I hope he doesn't do it, because, you know, at that point he was like in his 60s, and it, you know, that was clearly not, and they kind of, I think they just waited him out a little, like they didn't, you don't, obviously you're not going to tell Frank Sinatra no, so they just kind of backburnered it until Frank Sinatra lost interest or gave up the rights, and then they turned it into Die Hard, because obviously you're like, well, Frank Sinatra couldn't be John McClane. Not in any universe would that have worked. So, but yeah, that was the weird connection to those films. So one other one of his that I want to mention before we get into Viva Knievel is Slaughter's Big Ripoff, the sequel to Slaughter, the blaxploitation film starring Jim Brown. You already mentioned that he was in, was it Rio Conchos you said he was in?
Rio Conchos.
Rio Conchos. So he's working with Jim Brown yet again, and Slaughter's Big Ripoff is fun because it is, you know, we see Gordon Douglas he's born in 1907, so this is 1973. So he's like, you know, what, like 65 years old at this point. And yet he's making a kind of gritty, grungy, R-rated blaxploitation movie filled with nudity. There's a sequence opening up the film where a guy in a plane strafes essentially a picnic with a machine gun, and it, the main villain, not the main villain, the main character at that point, outside of Slaughter, literally gets the top of his head shot off by bullets. It's not terribly bloody, but it is pretty graphic. I'm like, wow, the guy, we literally see the top of his head just come right off. And it features, of all people, Ed McMahon, Johnny Carson's Ed McMahon, as the main baddie. why it's Ed McMahon, I don't know. But it is, and that's fun to watch, because it's like, why is Ed why are we seeing this? But so again, once again, it's like Gordon Douglas could do a movie with giant ants, he could do a western with Lee Van Cleef, or he could do blaxploitation. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
That's actually one of the few Jim Brown movies I haven't seen, because I have seen a lot of Jim Brown's, because they are usually spectacularly violent and aggressive and yep. mean, and I love every second of them.
This one is. It's on YouTube. The whole thing's on YouTube, so you can watch it. It is a lot of fun. So at that point, you know, Gordon Douglas is getting older, and in his 50s, and it's in the 50s and 60s, he's cranking out two movies a year in some cases, sometimes even more than that. And then you're getting to the late 60s and they're maybe 1 or 2 years apart. And then you're to the 70s and now there are these big gaps. So he does a TV movie in 1975 and then he comes back to do 1977's Viva Knievel.
Before now, we move on to that.
Yes, sure.
I have to talk about I Was a Communist for the FBI.
Oh, yes, of course. I'm sorry you mentioned that. Yes, yeah, that is the, yes.
This is a movie that even Joseph McCarthy would have thought was paranoid propaganda. When I was done with the movie, I actually had to watch Red Dawn so I would have a more, I could feel better about communists. I would
a more balanced, nuanced take on
communists. It was a more balanced view. Because this movie it's basically, this guy is, an undercover for the FBI, infiltrating the Communist Party. And in the movie, the Communist Party is 100% a spy ring that is in touch with the Kremlin and are only acting to bring down America from the inside. And anytime, they want to bring up that, don't the communists represent the workers? Oh, like this is the character who is undercover who will always try to bring up like, I thought the Communist Party was about the workers. Oh, we just say that so that when we take over, they'll help us take over.
Pretty crafty, those communists.
I thought we were more about equality too. And then one of the communists using the N word as well. Ooh. Those N words have their uses. And the guy tries to correct him like, don't you mean, and he uses the other more appropriate N-word that I'm still not comfortable saying. And the guy says, no, I meant what I said. Hey, remember how we got them to riot in Detroit? And then when they were arrested, we raised funds for their defense. And another one jumps in and said, that's right. We raised $2 million for their defense, but only spent $2,000 and they went to jail. We kept the rest of the money.
Wow.
And throughout the film, the guy's brother and son despise him for being a communist to the point where at his mother's funeral, his brother starts a fist fight with him for showing up. Like, how dare you show up at our mother's funeral, you commie pinko bastard. And the son hates him because I'm picked on at school because my dad's a communist. And at the end of the movie, when he breaks his cover in front of the House of Un-American Activity Committee, to expose the communists for what they are. The brother and son are, for some reason, in the crowd, and they get these big beaming smiles on their faces like, oh, thank God, he wasn't really a communist. He was a hero working for the FBI. And the son runs up to him and embraces his dad like, Dad, I'm so sorry for what I put you through. I'm so sorry for hating you. And the dad's like, no, son, I loved you for hating me because you hated me because you thought I was a communist. And that was right.
Wow.
It is done in a completely serious tone. It almost feels like this is the type of film they would show in, junior high, to educate these kids against what the communists are doing.
It sounds like something J. Edgar Hoover would have shown the agents, this is what we're up against, boys.
Exactly.
Is there anybody famous in it?
No, not. I believe the lead guy was a popular actor, but I can't think of his name off the top of my head. I believe he does have a string of credits.
Okay. Wow.
I'm sure I've seen him in other things.
Is it budget wise? I guess it sounds like from the title, it was like a B picture, right? It's not a big budget thing.
Yes, but it is a nice looking movie. At least the print I saw was really nice.
Interesting.
Most like what Gordon Douglas did. He just brought you, he brought you a film from what the material he was given.
Wow. I wonder what his feelings were about it. I wonder what his political leanings were. Was he endorsing this? Was he like, yeah, this is all right? Or was he one of those guys who was like, you know what? I'll make the most rabidly frothing at the mouth anti-communist movie imaginable, and that way no one will ever suspect me because I made this ridiculous over-the-top movie. Or maybe not. Maybe none of those things that he was like we were talking about earlier. It's a job. I need a job. It's a job.
They won't be blacklisting me.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh man, that does sound fun. Is that, where did you see that? Is that on YouTube, or did you own that?
The what was it? The Internet Archive.
Oh, okay. Oh man, yeah, that sounds fun. So I'm glad you brought that up. So anyway, yeah, let's finally talk about Viva Knievel. This film was released June 1st, 1977, 1 week after Star Wars. Sorcerer, William Friedkin's superb Sorcerer, is famous for being the film that Star Wars kind of just crushed. And it really, you know, in a lot of ways, it was a harbinger of the end of the 70s, the end of the auteur 70s, because you've got this, not that Star Wars wasn't sort of a personal vision of George Lucas's, but obviously it ushered in a whole new form of film, movie entertainment, and the kind of movie that the Sorcerer definitely was not. But this film, Viva Knievel, got crushed in the wake of the Star Destroyers as well. And, you know, before we even talk about the plot and the cast, this is a movie that goes wrong from the beginning and continues to go wrong. Like, virtually every creative choice is wrong. As much as you can objectively say something is wrong when you talk about a piece of quote unquote art, but everything about Viva Knievel is wrong. And I'm going to guess, Matt, that like me, you can enjoy a really bad movie if it's entertaining in its own level.
Oh, I mean, I enjoy all types of film, you know, good, bad. To me, the only bad film is a boring film. Any film that fails to entertain me, that's a bad film. And even, you know, maybe I don't appreciate the film the way the filmmakers intended to for me to appreciate it. But if I have fun watching it, and you can usually tell that even a low budget movie, if it was made with care and the people behind it really cared and really put themselves forward to make the best possible thing they make, it usually comes through and is an entertaining film. Night of the Living Dead, I think, is probably one of the best examples of that. You know, a group of people who came together to make the best film they possibly could, and they made a blockbuster.
Yeah, I've seen, I agree. A movie that's boring to me is almost, that's the cardinal sin. I've seen movies whose budgets were probably, a single budget for one film was probably more than it cost Gordon Douglas to make all 98 of his movies. And yet, like an hour in, I'm like, this is, I'm so disengaged with what I'm watching, even though this studio is throwing literally hundreds of millions of dollars onto the screen. I am bored out of my skull. And that is, to me, that is the worst crime. Viva Knievel is never boring. It is just wrong footed again from the very beginning. So let me get into the plot a little bit, and we'll talk about the cast, and then we will discuss the myriad ways to enjoy this movie. So with the assistance of his mechanic, Will, Evil Knievel prepares for his next death-defying stunt jump. A photojournalist named Kate Morgan arrives on assignment to capture shots of Evil in case he dies attempting this latest stunt. That almost happens when Evil crashes his bike in the jump and lands in the hospital. He announces his retirement even after being offered a series of huge paydays if he performs some jumps down in Mexico, put together by his former protege, Jesse, who is secretly backed by some drug dealers who want to use Evil as an unwitting mule to sneak cocaine into the U.S. Will stumbles onto the plot and is drugged and put into a psychiatric hospital. Evil decides to unretire, thanks partly to Will's son, who has just arrived from boarding school and looks up to Evil. Jesse, hopped up on drugs, knocks Evil out before the big jump to prove he is the better stuntman. The mob bosses don't know this, so when they explode Evil's bike mid-jump, they don't realize that they are killing Jesse. Evil then breaks Will out of the sanitarium, and they go looking for Kate and Will's son, who have been kidnapped by the drug dealers and put into a duplicate Evil Knievel trailer. Will rescues them as Evil goes after the drug dealers, leading them to crashing their car. Evil finds Kate, who has now fallen in love with him, Will, and Will's son. Later, Evil performs yet another stunt, this time successfully. Cue the music. Evil Knievel plays himself. Lauren Hutton is photojournalist Kate Morgan. Gene Kelly is alcoholic, former stunt driver, and now mechanic Will. Leslie Nielsen plays the head of the mob, Stanley Millard. Red Buttons plays Evil's Booker, Ben Andrews. Cameron Mitchell plays a mob enforcer named Barton. Dabney Coleman is the psychiatric hospital doctor who is in league with the mob named Dr. Thompson. Marjo Gortner is Jesse. And Frank Gifford plays himself. The film was ghost produced by Irwin Allen and Sheila Allen, Irwin's wife, who we talked about a couple episodes ago in the When Time Ran Out, is an uncredited role as Sister Charity in an opening scene that is just has to be seen to be believed. Wow. This movie. Would you agree with me, Matt, that the minute the decision was made, whoever made it, that Evel Knievel should play himself, that pretty much doomed the movie, and there was just no way to ever recover from that?
Well, I think the problem is, and I have no way of knowing this for sure, but I think the biggest problem is the movie may not really star Evel Knievel. It may have starred Evel Knievel's ego. And that may have doomed the movie, because obviously the whole conceit and the I'm sure the elevator pitch was Evel Knievel is going to star as himself.
Right.
We're going to make, because at that time, this was just before, you know, he was charged and arrested for assault. So
beating a guy with an aluminum bat.
Which, come on, you know, not regulation evil. What are you doing? But, yeah, and again, maybe even if it was a few years earlier where evil really was at the height of his, you know, career and, you know, super popular guy, the number one toy on the shelves for Christmas. But yeah, because Evel Knievel, he was a stuntman daredevil, but he was not an actor.
No, he's awful even in this movie.
You don't believe him when he says, I'm Evel Knievel.
He can't even sell that successfully. Yeah, he is dead on arrival in this movie. And it's funny because there was an Evel Knievel biopic starring George Hamilton called Evel Knievel from 1972. I feel like this movie is just, it missed its window in that Evel's, you and I both grew up in the 70s. I'm a little older than you, but we both essentially were very young in the 70s, but we're old enough to remember the 70s. And Evel Knievel was everywhere back then. There were toys, there were posters. Like, he was a great marketer. You and I both know he was on the back cover of comic books for about what seemed like about 3 years straight for that wind up toy that he had. Did you ever have that?
I actually did. It was again one of my uncles on my dad's side who had just outgrown it, passed it on to me, and I had so much fun. I have the Stunts uncle with the, you know, the gyro launcher and the stadium carry case for him to crash into. And usually, yeah, what would happen, despite the commercials, you would rev it up, he would roll off, go about 3 feet, fall over.
Much like Evil himself. I mean, it's the kind of thing where, and I'm like, on one hand, I'm like, well, I can't blame Gordon Douglas, because what can he do, right? If Evel Knievel, this guy cannot act, what's he going to do? But then he could say, well, but Gordon Douglas could have not taken the movie. And I mean, you know, the minute he heard that Evel Knievel was playing himself, he might have said, that's never going to work, so forget it. But, you know, maybe he tried it. Now, I will say, maybe Gordon thought he could mold Evel Knievel into a performance, because Gordon Douglas did do something similar in the 50s. He directed 1956's Sincerely Yours, starring Liberace as essentially himself as a romantic lead right there. And that movie was apparently such a massive failure that Warner Brothers had contracted Liberace to star in two pictures. And after this film, Sincerely Yours, flopped so mightily, they basically paid Liberace to not make a second film. They bought him out of his contract and they were like, never mind. And Liberace would go on to make cameo appearances here and there. He appeared on the Batman TV show, but he never, ever starred in a feature film again. So his one shot playing, again, essentially himself, was a miserable failure. Maybe Gordon Douglas thought, I don't know, I've learned. I can, you know, and I'm going to say Liberace is not great in the movie. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the flaws in that film as they relate to Viva Knievel. And this is, it's a shame that it's Liberace pre the really amazing Elton John-esque outfits, which is, again, kind of similar to Evel Knievel in a lot of ways. He's very muted in the Sincerely Yours. But maybe Gordon Douglas thought, I can do this. I can take a guy who's not a natural actor and mold him into a performance. Now, when he's talking about Evel Knievel, he's dead wrong. And part of the problem is the script is written by two guys, Antonio Santin, who passed away in 2014. His big previous credit was Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. And Norman Katkov passed away in 2009. He wrote a lot of TV, Mission Impossible, Dynasty, Ben Casey, The Adventures of Captain Nemo, which was an Irwin Allen TV show. But the part of the problem is they write Evel as not a nice guy. His scenes with Kate Morgan, the photojournalist, he's rude to her from the very beginning. I guess they're trying to do like a Tracy Hepburn thing, like, ooh, they're sparring, but he just seems like a dick. And so it's like, why would you? And then he also mentioned he hires Red Buttons, who is this sort of shifty promoter. And you're like, well, why is this guy? He hired him. Why did he? Why would, you know? So it makes the script makes Evel kind of look like a jerk, which is, would be working against any actor, gifted or not. And then you pile on that it's a guy who is not an actor and can't act. You're just dooming this thing from the first frame.
Well, you know, to that effect, you know, like you mentioned, where he worked with Liberace, he directed Jim Brown's first movie, who was a football player.
Right,
Jim
there Brown, you go.
You know, so maybe he, you know, again, along that line, he's like, maybe I can do this with Evel Knievel. We got a big budget, you know, with, you know, a popular guy. It's supposed to be about stunt daredevil stuff. Well, who better to do that than Evel Knievel? But yeah, the, as you pointed out, he's not a likable character and he's not a good actor. And the movie is obviously Evel Knievel must have had some sort of creative control because the movie opens with him delivering toys, his own toys, by the way. He is delivering those ideal stunt racer sets to an orphanage. And
he heals the sick. There's one kid throws his crutches away because Evil's such an inspiration to him.
Yes. And even the angry nun who admonishes him for coming in the middle of the night to give out these toys, as soon as they're out of sight from the children, she's like, oh, Evel, you've done it again. You marvelous, marvelous man.
Thanks, Sister Charity. Oh, oh God. It's just, yeah, it's such a bizarre. It's such a weird thing because like that opening scene, right, is so family friendly. Right. They're, I mean, Evil's big thing was that he could merchandise himself. Right. That's how he made his money because these stunt shows that he did where half the time seems like he was crashing was that, you know, he made his money that way, but he really made his money from selling merchandise of himself and all that other kind of stuff. So it seems like they're going for like a family friendly, straight ahead kind of, you know, action thriller, but yet it's got all these sordid characters and this plot is, The mob, again, headed by Leslie Nielsen, which is just absolutely fantastic. And again, he's got his henchmen, Albert Sahmi and Cameron Mitchell. And then you've got Marjo Gortner, future televangelist, Marjo Gortner, as his unwitting accomplice.
Former televangelist at this point.
Oh, was he former now? Okay, right.
He was a child evangelist, yeah.
Oh, was he? Oh, I thought he became an evangelist after he was actor.
No, he was a child evangelist at the age of 4, I believe.
Okay. All right. I know there's a documentary about him, which I have never seen, that we had it at the video store that I worked at. But so, and like Marjo Gortner is like doing cocaine. Like it's a really sordid plot. And so you're like, is this a family friendly movie that is a delivery system for Evel Knievel as a movie star? Or is it like a gritty crime thriller? And it's like, it's neither one of those things. And so it's just this jangled mishmash of stuff. And then you've got this whole subplot with Gene Kelly, the Gene Kelly, as an angry alcoholic ex stunt rider who's working for Evel, and Evil's kind of giving him a second chance. And his son arrives from boarding school and he looks like the kid from The Omen. And Gene Kelly's character hates his own son. The kid shows up thanks to Evil's getting involved. And Gene Kelly's like, I don't have time to be. So it's this whole subplot where like, Gene Kelly's a jerk. Like, who am I supposed to like in this movie?
I thought the kid looked like Angus Young walking off the cover of the off the cover of one of the albums.
You're doing that duck walk, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just such a weird mix.
So much doesn't make sense. So, like you mentioned, when, you know, Lauren Hutton, who plays the former photojournalist, first arrived, Evil's nasty to her. But remember, he's at this event where he's, you know, going to be doing his jump, and he's got his fans all around him, and he's signing autographs, and he's hitting on the women. And then all of a sudden, a helicopter just flies in and lands about 20 yards away, and everybody's like, what is this? What's going on? And you look at the helicopter, and at first I'm like, it looks like the characters from Dawn of the Dead took a wrong turn. It's almost the same helicopter. Like, you know, can you tell us where the Monroeville Mall is, please? But it lands, and out comes Lauren Hutton, who just saunters off the helicopter like, you know, she just got out of a taxi, climbs up on top of a car and starts snapping pictures. And
he right in his face, like, too, like right in his nose. I'm like, what are these pictures? Yeah.
And he's like, well, what's going on? What are you doing here? She goes, oh, well, I'm here to cover you. Oh, you're here to cover my jump? No, I'm here to cover if you die in this spectacular crash. So she doesn't really give him much reason to be nice to her either, so.
That is true. But I mean, but one of the lines they give him, though, I mean, they're like, all that is true, Matt. That's absolutely true. By the way, when she lands in the helicopter, just off to the right hand side, there's like a marching band. And like the marching band have those big plumed feathers on their hats. And like, I really wanted the chopper blade to like whisk off the top of those feathers just as like a sight gag. But one of the lines they give Evil is when she introduces herself and she's like, I'm Miss Kate Morgan. And he's like, Are you a Mrs. or a Ms? And he's kind of like, he's like doing like, are you one of those, like those feminists? And you're like, what? Like, why would you give him this personality? And by the way, in real life, Evil was married and had children. They leave all that stuff out. So like in the movies, romance, I get, so it's like, it's sort of a biopic, but not really. But like, why make him kind of like a misogynist jerk? Yeah, she's being rude to him, but like, why take that tack with him? You know,
because that's how the ladies liked it in the '70s. At least that's what I. That's yeah. At least that's what the movies I watch tell me.
That's right. Yeah. Well. Yeah. I think if unless movies have lied to me, I do gotta wonder. Right. We finally get to see Evil's show, and he starts it off with this very strange speech out of nowhere about how you shouldn't do drugs, which again, I guess he's trying to sell himself as this sort of like arbiter of, you know, family entertainment. And
again, to be fair to Evil, he did very much want to be take his, because whether he wanted, he obviously wanted to be a role model, and he did at least take that aspect, except for beating a guy up with an aluminum bat, but he did at least really try to sell an anti-drug stay-in-school message to his fans. So
okay. All right. So that was from his real act then.
Yes.
Okay. But I mean, they cut to the crowd, and like the crowd's just kind of looking like, what is it? You know, just jump. But then I wonder. So like he does the jump and he crashes and he fails. What was his show in real life? Did they make everybody wait in line and sit in bleachers for 2 hours to see 7 minutes of content? I mean, what did it, to use a modern term? What was the show? One jump and then he's like, good night, everybody? That doesn't seem like a great value for your entertainment dollar.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like at least there was like a bit of what you might call a parade with the marching band, and Frank Gifford is announcing all the different vehicles that are in the Evel Knievel caravan and the money that's spent on them. And I believe, like, you know, part of it was like they would even have the rocket cycle that he used for the failed Snake River Canyon jump. So it was almost like a traveling museum of Evel Knievel. But yeah, I believe other than that, they just sat in those stands for however long it took for him to be ready to do the jump. And it was all that, you know, maybe a minute and a half of actual entertainment as he races down that ramp. I know at least I remember seeing it wasn't his jumps, but it would have been his son, Robbie Knievel, when he was doing some of the stunts in the 90s. And I remember those shows, watch them in a home. It would be an hour long special, and it would be 45 minutes of like the history of Evel Knievel and old clips and all this. And then finally, like in the last 10 minutes, okay, we're going to get ready to do the jump. And he would ride around and ride around. And with 5 minutes left to go before the end of the show, then there would be the stunt. And wow. I'm thinking, that's what I get to see at home. What are the people in the stands watching?
Yeah, they're seeing all the setup and all the this and the that. Yeah. Another curious choice is for a movie about a guy, his whole skill, he's not personable, you know, so he doesn't have that. And he's obviously not, you know, particularly like an action star. Like, he's not terribly mobile because we know he broke like 79 bones or whatever in the course of his life, is the stunt riding, right? So what do we see him do? He does two jumps, one of which he fails miserably at. Like, that's it. And the other one that he makes is the very end of the movie. I'm like, this is our amazing stunt rider. He does two jumps and one of them, his fail rate is 50% in this movie.
Although you do got to enjoy that. Well, whether you enjoy it or not, but that slow-mo when he misses the landing and you see him tumble, they really filmed that to within an inch of his life, because they just, you see every bounce, every tumble, every spin as he is tumbling along. And it is both amazing. It is almost a literal crash. You don't want to watch it. You cannot look away.
It's compelling. Yeah. Cause it's real. Although we did learn that there apparently was a stunt rider for some scenes in this movie, which they tried to hide because obviously his whole thing is that he's a stuntman. But that also, you know, that underscores, well, that's the realities of a film production. Yeah. You know, you can't have your star doing all the stunts, because if he hurts himself, you have to shut the whole production down. But it's so weird that he's treated as this sort of like, you know, he's like a combination of Elvis and the president. Wherever he goes down to Mexico and he gets an immediate meeting with like the government officials. And there are mobs of press like following his every move. I'm like, I don't think he was that big of a deal. Well,
that's the whole premise of the drug lord's plan, is that they're going to lure him down to Mexico, sabotage his stunt so that he's killed, and then smuggle the drugs back into the United States in his caravan, because how dare the Border Patrol stop and search the funeral cortege of a national hero like Evel Knievel? They won't possibly think anything. Nope, that's Evel Knievel's corpse. Just wave it through. Just wave it on through. You know. What do they got back there? Oh, it looks like they're smuggling some ingredients. All right, just wave it through. Bottles of wine and leather goods. Just keep going. It's the corpse of Evel Knievel. Don't stop this.
Again, what a weird plot to hinge your movie on. You know, what a straight. Oh, by the way, there's a really fun moment in that scene where they go to Mexico, where Kate Morgan and Will have arrived there following Evel in a car, and they've driven together. Now, they're driving from California to Mexico, so it's not like that long of a drive, but it's at least several hours. And we learned from one line of dialogue that Kate has been giving Will grief for the entire trip about how he's treating his son. And I'm like, these two characters just met for the first time like a day ago, and she's already kind of like telling him what to do with his son.
It is a super bizarre family dynamic they set up here, because like you said, Will hates his son. Knievel adores the son. The son adores Knievel. And Lauren Hutton suddenly becomes the mother figure who's trying to get this whole family to work out. Like, you treat him like gold and don't discipline it. And you hate him. So is he really your son? It's just so, so bizarre. It almost like an after school special of, you know, of an adopted family. And how, you know, you've chosen this family. You should love each other.
And then there's a scene where Gene Kelly yells at his son after he thinks the kid has made Evel spill his bike because he was distracted. And like, it's Gene Kelly is just too talented for this material, because he's yelling at kid. He's like, look what you did. And he's like, you know, genuinely terrifying, because again, he's kind of like out of control a little bit. He's a rageaholic. And you're like, again, you just feel so bad for Gene Kelly wasting his time in this material with this material.
Xanadu must have felt like a blessing a few years later.
You know, I've seen Xanadu. Xanadu is fun compared to the. I mean, this is fun too. This is a fun movie to watch, but it is just, you're just sort of sitting there going, I can't believe they thought this worked in any capacity.
I think that's another major problem is they surrounded evil with talented actors. And that was a mistake because the man can't act. And it just looks even worse when you have him amongst the talents of Leslie Nielsen, Dabney Coleman, Lauren Hutton, and Gene Kelly. You know, it's like maybe they should have filmed it with even more like B-movie actors or actors who weren't quite as skilled in their craft. And maybe it would have had a more even tone amongst it. And you wouldn't have noticed that evil is so terrible at it.
Yes. But, yeah.
I feel this movie's real failing is it's not crazy enough. It's not stupid enough. This movie should have gone. There's somehow a superhero. Evil Knievel is a superhero type of thing. And they should have just gone for it. And this, you know, we like Gordon Douglas. We respect him. This is a movie that needed Hal Needham to be directing it.
Deeds, not words.
It needed to be like, you know, Evil Knievel is being chased by the drug, you know, by the bad guys. And the bad guys are like, don't worry, he can't escape us. You know, I have the route blocked by 14 buses. There's no way he can jump 14 buses. And then he jumps the 14 buses, and the bad guys get out of their car and throw their hats to the ground and shake their fists at Evil Knievel as he rides away.
I could see Leslie Nielsen doing that. They're
in their bunker. There's no way Evil Knievel can get in here and rescue the hostages. We have a moat surrounding our bunker, and it's filled with live alligators and a 50-foot wall. I mean, granted, there's a hole in the wall, but we've set that on fire, so now it's a flaming hole in the wall. There's no way he can jump over the boat through the flaming hole and get in here and rescue. Oh, darn it, there he is! That's what this movie should have been.
It's like what they say in politics. It's like, let evil be evil. You know, like, stop trying to mold him into this family man kind of guy and make this gonzo balls to the wall action stunt epic, which that highlights his skill. I think that makes total sense, Matt.
But I actually also think that it was evil who made the decision that no, let's keep this grounded. I want to be the realistic, you know, common man who's the hero. And I think that must probably have been the movie's fit. Because, you know, anytime it goes away from evil, anytime we see what's going on with the villains and their plotting, the movie really seems to pick up.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. There's a scene where Gene Kelly gets drugged because they know he's an alcoholic. So, like, the bad guys are like, oh, well, we'll drug him. And then they'll think he's just a drunk. And Marjo Gordner slips a Mickey into his booze. And then Marjo Gordner is taking photos, or Jesse is taking photos of Evil's stunt cycle. And Gene Kelly's character is like wandering in and out of consciousness. And I mean, it's a small scene, but it's well done. Like, it's effectively staged as like, oh, this is, you know, how disconcerting this has got to be to, like, you're drifting in and out of consciousness. And it's not a horror sequence. I'm going to go that far, but it has some genuine tension to it. And it's well directed by, again, and edited. It's well directed by Gordon Douglas. But yeah, you're right. It's the stuff with evil make the movie kind of drags down once he shows up. And that's the opposite. He should be the guy that is like the spark of this movie.
And for the grand finale, when, you know, his partner is in mechanic is being held in the asylum, and the son and Lauren Hutton have been kidnapped by the drug lords. And finally, we're going to get this big sequence where he's going to jump on his motorcycle and save the day. They put him in an orange jumpsuit as opposed to his famous...
The costume. You know, yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
This would have been the ultimate
choice.
Show of him being a superhero. And then even when he, you know, breaks Gene Kelly out of the asylum. It is so underwhelming. Again, we're talking about the bad points of the show. We enjoy it. It's a lot of fun to watch.
It is.
But when you think about what they could have done without even really increasing the budget all that much, you know, he could have, you know, why doesn't he jump his motorcycle into the second floor window? He just drives, you know, he drives it into the asylum, but it's not done like it's some sort of daring do epic, you know, invasion of the hospital. He just kind of rides it in and he pulls the gun to shoot the lock off the door and they ride away.
Yeah. That's it. Right. That's it. Exactly. It's so funny. I've seen this movie probably half a dozen times and it never really occurred. I mean, again, it doesn't work, but it is still entertaining on its own level. But you're right. That really is what they should have done. They should have just said, let's save the money we're spending on Gene Kelly and Lauren Hutton for however expensive they are, and just make a gonzo fun action adventure movie, which highlights evil skill. But as you're saying, I would bet, we don't know, we're supposing here, but that it was evil who wanted to try something different and he just wasn't capable of it. And it makes me think of something that I saw in the Liberace movie, which that's not a sentence you get to say very much, but there's a scene in that movie where he's doing a show for a crowd and he does this little lesson. Lesson sounds very dry. I don't mean it to be, but he does, the camera is just pointed at him and it's a one shot, you know, it's unbroken, and it's him teaching the audience how to play boogie woogie. And he does this little lesson about piano playing. Now, I know nothing about how to play music. I'm envious of anyone who knows how to make music. So I find anyone that can make music, to me, that's like alchemy. Like, how do you possibly have the skill to create this sound that sounds like anything, but people do it. And he does this demonstration where he's showing, well, you play the boogie boogie here with your right hand, and then you do this with your left hand. And as I said, the camera's just pointed on him for a solid maybe 3-4 minutes. And it's really fascinating. And you're like, yeah, Liberace's really interesting to watch because he's doing the thing he knows how to do, which is play the piano. But then he spends the rest of the movie romancing Joanne Drew. And you're like, what am I watching? Why is he doing this? And I feel like it's the same thing here where you're like, is it what? I guess the idea of putting him in a movie, it's like, well, let's turn him into a movie star. Let's turn him into a leading man. It's like, no, that's not what he's good at. You know, evil's good at jumping over flaming moats with crocodiles in it. Have him do that. So yeah, that might have been, been something if they had let that movie be the movie.
Jumping the motorcycle just for the sake of jumping the motorcycle. I mean, you think about some of those old low budget Mexican movies that were starring those Mexican wrestlers.
Yeah, look
where, you know, they're fighting vampires and traveling through time. They're completely insane, but they are oh so entertaining.
That you is know, true. Yeah.
At the end of the movie, when both Evil and Gene Kelly are on their motorcycles chasing after the bad guys because they still have Lauren Hutton and the son held hostage. And right. Gene Kelly's going to be the distraction to draw away the bad guys in the Corvette. And Evil's going to attack the truck that has the hostages in it. Evil jumps and lands his bike on top of the truck, but they don't even show it. It's not like it should have been the spectacular action stunt piece of the movie, but it's really just like implied that that's what he did. It is the guy playing Gene Kelly has a more spectacular action sequence, stunt sequence when he ends up riding his motorcycle over a cliff. Evil Knievel's character doesn't even get the most daring part of the movie.
Yeah, that's right. And you're so right about the orange jumpsuit that he's stuck in this weird orange jumpsuit when he's not wearing. I mean, you're right. He's a superhero. It's like making a superhero movie where the superhero Batman takes off his cowl for the last action sequence. You're like, what? That's not, no.
And it's not like he was disguising himself as like, well, I'm going to dress up as one of the bad guys in this orange suit. No, he just gets dressed up in that orange suit.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll never know why this movie was designed the way it was, as far as we know. I mean, the movie is on DVD. It's not on Blu-ray yet. I've started doing audio commentaries for some Blu-ray catalog titles. I will put it out there. I will try and manifest this. Warner Brothers, if you ever want to do an Viva Knievel Blu-ray, I would be happy to. Matt, you and I could do it together. You could do an audio commentary for the Blu-ray. It is the one thing about this movie that does work tonally, and I think you'll agree, Matt, is the theme song. The opening theme at the beginning, at the end, is an earworm. It is so fun. One fine day, a man came to town, a king of the road with a helmet for a crown, a motorcycle bird who is never coming down. And it's got this great comic book style graphic of him on this road that's made of stars and stripes. It looks like something you would have seen in the Captain America TV movies that were made around the same time. By the way, he also rode a motorcycle in those movies, a red, white, and blue motorcycle. The theme is a banger.
It is a lot of fun. You know, and honestly, if the movie in many ways feels like the pilot for a proposed Evel Knievel adventure TV series where, you know, week to week, the Evel Knievel stunt show would travel to another town and he'd run into a random group of people that, you know, needed help in some way, you know, like, oh, you know, old Tex here, we're going to lose the ranch. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm gonna jump my bike over all your raging bulls in the corral, and well, the money I make will save your ranch. Or, you know, he'll come across another community where, you know, oh, these evil landowners are trying to run us off our land and build condos. What can you do for us, Evil? Almost like an A-Team Knight Rider type of thing.
I was going to say, it sounds like a little Incredible Hulk mixed in with like Dukes of Hazzard, you know, like stunt driving, but going from town to town and helping people that you find there. Yeah. That would have been a fun show.
and the traveling, you know, Evel Knievel show would have been the reason for, you know, going from town to town.
And you could have sold toys like that forever, because you have a weekly reminder to buy toys. Well, it didn't work out for anybody. I said Evel ended his own career basically by getting arrested just 3 months later after this film. And that really ended his career. I mean, he continued to be famous. I remember seeing him in stuff in the '80s, but he, as a cultural force, he was pretty much over at that point because, you know, good Lord, the guy got arrested. Nowadays people get arrested and, people seem to like that. But back then that was kind of a bad thing. And it sort of ended his career, and it ended Gordon Douglas's career. Now, as I mentioned, Gordon Douglas lived all the way until 1993, so 16 more years. And maybe he just finally had enough money to retire and just said to hell with it. Or maybe the experience of this film was so, upsetting or disappointing that he was like, forget it. I don't want to subject myself to this again. It also could be that, you know, the entertainment world was changing. And Star Wars literally just landed right on top of this movie. And Gordon Douglas's kind of skills probably weren't necessarily as marketable. Who knows? Maybe let's stay positive and say he just decided, you know what? I've had a great life. I'm going to spend time with my family and my grandkids, and I'm just going to enjoy life. And he got to live for, again, another decade and a half. And he did live long enough to get some retrospectives of at least some of his films, you know, get appreciated, them. And especially you got to see that film became so renowned. So this was it for both Gordon Douglas and Evel Knievel. Two other things I want to mention. There is a punk band called Viva Knievel. So this film did inspire at least some other creative types. And I learned that around the time of this film, there was via Bally an Evel Knievel pinball machine, which of course is natural because this Evel Knievel is a perfect subject. As someone who owns loves pinball and owns a movie themed pinball machine, I can't foresee ever owning a second one, but man, if I ever came across an Evel Knievel pinball machine, I would at the very least ask to play it, because that sounds like that's probably a blast.
I wonder if you have to jump the balls up a ramp over a series of buses. That would be cool.
That would be good. They absolutely, if that's the game, you should absolutely have to push the ball across some chasms. At the very least, that should be that game. You know, it's probably really hard to do, but that's the point of it. So that's Viva Knievel, everybody. Like I mentioned, you can get it on Blu-ray. You can rent it, but it is also on YouTube for free. It's a little long. It's like an hour and 45. That's a little longer than this film really needs to be. Could have cut all the stuff out with Gene Kelly's son, I think, and you probably would have been fine. But it is still a lot of fun. I watch it every so often, and it is just such a gorgeous hunk of cheese that it's really fun to watch.
Honestly, if you do enjoy like Dukes of Hazzard or Chips Patrol or, you know, any of those late 70s, early 80s adventure TV shows, I think you'll get a kick out of it.
Absolutely.
It's a lot of fun. I mean, I know we basically poked fun at the more negative aspects, but it is, you know, it is a lot of fun. You'll enjoy it, I think.
It is. It's never dull. It is never dull. Like we talked about earlier, dull being the worst thing a movie can be. Viva Knievel is not dull at any point. You just, if anything, you just get to play Spot the Star. You know, yes. Like, oh my God, wow, Leslie Nielsen in this movie and Marjo Gordon. Like, people just keep popping up in little roles. I mean, Red Buttons. I mean, it's just so fun to watch in that regard. So we definitely could recommend it. And so good on you, Gordon Douglas. It's probably Viva Knievel is probably not a fun production, but you made something fun that people are still watching. At least these two movie nerds are still watching all of 40 years later. So well done, sir. And Matt, thank you for doing this. I said you and I have recorded together before, and it's a lot of fun. And I really been wanting to do Viva Knievel almost since I started Fade Out, and I never thought I'd get a chance to do it. So I really appreciate you stepping up and doing the show with me.
Oh, I'm so happy I got a chance to do it myself.
Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Okay, well, I have my own podcast along with my brother. It's called the TV Movie Rewind Podcast, and it's basically us covering the films we love. So you go through the list of films, you know, if you want to watch, we got about 130 episodes out there now. It's all movies we love. If we don't love it, we don't think it's worth talking about.
I know you recently did Megaforce, which this film could have used a little of that razzmatazz.
Yeah, exactly.
Use a little bit of that.
And you know what? We just covered Josie Wales, which is a good movie about an incredibly unlikable character.
There you go.
So, you know, there's ways to make that work, too.
Absolutely. So
you can find me on Twitter/X, Blue Sky, and Instagram under Movie Matt Sirois, all one word, MovieMattSirois. And, you know, chat me up there. I'm usually talking about movies or comic books. They're my two passions.
Yeah, the show you did previously with me was an episode of my show Mountain Comics, where we talked about an issue of Kazar, which was also very macho. So you and I tend to cover really macho subjects. I don't think either one of us are particularly macho guys, but that seems to be the stuff that we are destined to cover together.
Well, you know what? Maybe we'll get to one of those Mexican wrestler shows or something starring Mr. T or Lee Majors.
Yeah, that would be good. There was the A-Team comic book for Marvel in the 80s. We could cover that. That would be kind of fun. Who knows?
How did that only run 3 issues?
I don't know. Evel Knievel should have been in the A-Team. Maybe not a regular, but like you should have guessed it. That would have been, you know.
Oh, that would have been
perfectly.
Boy George was a fantastic guest. You think what a Evel Knievel could have done?
That would have been a real rating spike, you know? So, well, anyway, Matt, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And thank you all for listening. You can find all the back episodes of Fade Out on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show in any podcatcher of your choice. We are over on Twitter and Blue Sky as Fade Out Pod. And finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FWPodcast. And there you can unlock various awards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Monique D for her support of Fade Out. I very much appreciate it. So thanks for listening. We'll be back with another Fade Out before you know it. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script. So it's time to Fade Out. Viva Knievel.
Come on, Will, let's show Tommy around.
Oh, thanks. I gotta do some work in the flex. Go ahead.
Tommy, your dad takes great care of these bikes for me. He's the best in the world at it. That helps to take care of my life, too. Hey, want to see my van? I think you'll like it.